Hello and welcome to episode 109 of the Machine Ethics Podcast. This time we're talking with James Barrett. This was recorded January 8th, 2026. James and I talk about Arthur C. Clarke and documentary making, superintelligence, AI basic drives and the alignment problem, the intelligence explosion, and indeed James's new book, The Intelligence Explosion, the existential risks of AI, and people choosing profit over responsibility, bolt holes for the super rich, more possible AI regulation, the addictiveness of LLMs, the stupidity of the Trump administration, and much, much more. This time we're again sponsored by Aria. AI innovation shouldn't compromise ethics or security. Meet Aria, the AI platform that empowers everyone on your team, from non-coder beginners to pro developers, to innovate responsibly. With enterprise-grade security, cost controls, and a prototyping studio for rapid, safe experimentation, Aria ensures you can build smarter AI while managing risks, safeguarding data, and staying compliant. Transform chaos into streamlined AI control. Future-proof your business, unleash innovation, and embrace AI responsibly with Aria. Learn more at aria.com. That's A-I-R-I-A.com. If you like this episode, you can find more at machine-ethics.net. You can contact us, hello@machine-ethics.net. You can follow us on Blue Sky, machine-ethics.net, Instagram, Machine Ethics Podcast, YouTube, @machine-ethics. And if you can, you can support us on Patreon, patreon.com/machine-ethics. Thanks for listening and hope you enjoy. Hi, James. Thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So if you could introduce yourself to our audience, who are you and what do you do?
I'm James Barrett. You can find out more about me at jamesbarrett.com, B-A-R-R-A-T, the correct spelling, .com. I'm an author of two books about AI, Our Final Invention and The Intelligence Explosion, and also a book about suicide. And I'm a documentary filmmaker, and I've made literally a dozen or more, a couple of dozen films in my 30-plus year career as a documentary filmmaker. And that's what I do. I make documentary films and I write books.
And are you still doing, are those things kind of crossing over? Because obviously
we
are talking about, you know, it's the Machine Ethics Podcast. We're talking about AI and technology and the impact of society and those things. So, you know, in your documentary making, have you covered some of that stuff in the past? Or how did you get to where you are in this thinking at the moment?
It's a long and winding story, but I'll try to make it very brief. I still make documentaries. What I would like to do is I'll give you an example. I made a documentary about suicide for PBS, and suicide is at a incredibly fast rate here in the United States. It's an epidemic, and what I wanted to do was get out information about what to look for, what signs to look for in your family or in your colleagues that they may be considering suicide. So I did that film, and then I had all the makings for a book. I had all the interviews. I'd been to all the locations, and so I wrote a book. Mm. And that's really my modus operandi. I get obsessed with some problem or issue like AI, and then I decide if that's going to be a better book or movie. And the thing about AI is it's not yet very visual. It's getting visual with, once we marry robotics with AI, then it'll be extremely visual. But right now it's not a great, and I've participated in some AI documentaries. I've been in them and they're just, they're not visually very exciting.
Yeah, there's a lot of talking heads and that sort of thing, right?
It's a lot of talking. It's a ton. And I don't mind talking heads. And if I'm watching a documentary, I better see some talking heads, because it's a human face is about the most interesting thing you can put on TV, in my opinion. And seeing where the ideas come from is really interesting. And that's why when I write books or make films, the great pleasure of this is that I can go to the experts and get access quickly. If I say I'm working for National Geographic or PBS and I'm making a film about suicide, the doors just open. And the same with writing books. If, now I've developed a little track record. So if I'm someplace and I want to interview someone, the answer is generally yes, which is just great for me. Because then, I got to interview Arthur C. Clarke for a film. And it was one of the great pleasures of my life. I spent a day with him in Sri Lanka. where he lives, where he lived. He's dead. He died in, I think, 2011 or 12. No, earlier, 2005 maybe. But anyway, that, and I started writing books before I started making films, but I didn't get any published. For you aspiring writers out there, just stick to it, keep at it. You can break through. It took me a while, but then I did.
And that, so, I mean, obviously Clark, a complete legend, obviously,
Oh my gosh.
in science fiction. We could talk about that for a while, but what I want to do is loop back. We're talking about, probably more specifically two of your books. But obviously, it's a, we can meander. So what I wanted to know is when you throw around these ideas, we were talking about AI, these terms, like what is that? What to you is AI? And then kind of why did you start thinking about this? Because obviously your first book was over 10 years ago now. I don't know if you can keep these two questions in your mind, but like it feels like you might be vindicated slightly about how things have gone, right? So tell me a bit about that.
Well, I hate to be right all the time, but everything I say has come true in that 2013 book. I've always been interested in AI, but I was like a big fan, and I still am a big fan. I read Ray Kurzweil's The Age of Spiritual Machines a long time ago, and I heard him interviewed on NPR, and I had to pull my car off the road to listen to it. And then I was making a film about the collaboration between Kubrick and Clark to make 2001: A Space Odyssey, and my first thought was, this is great. I can interview Ray Kurzweil, and he was very generous with his time, and I interviewed him. And then I interviewed Arthur C. Clarke, and the what I was a I don't want to say fanboy, I don't like that word, but I was a fanboy, and I wanted to port my brain to silicon substrate and live forever. And I could, according to Ray Kurzweil, if I lived long enough. I think one of his phrases was live long enough to live forever. And then I talked to Arthur C. Clarke, and he said this. He said, and he was such a great person to talk to about this, because he had made 2001: Space Odyssey, which has the HAL 9000, the homicidal robot, in it. And he said, we humans steer the future not because we're the fastest or the strongest creature, but because we're the most intelligent. When something shares our planet that's more intelligent than we are, they will steer the future. So there it is. It's all right there. When we share the planet with something more intelligent than us, they will steer the future. It's almost axiomatic. We are the smartest. I have a very intelligent dog. He's a German Shepherd. But he doesn't know what I'm doing most of the time. He doesn't understand me, in, except in the most, basic sense. I'm the source of food and walks. And but he doesn't understand anything about me. Just as Stephen Hawking said, we won't understand anything about superintelligence. It will develop weapons we don't understand. And we know what that's like. It's when you meet somebody that's extremely smart in a subject you don't know anything about, you feel stupid, as I felt during my first algebra class and my first calculus class. I knew what stupid people feel like because I was one in that domain. But that's what we will be when superintelligence comes, when anything smarter than us comes, and it's coming at us like a freight train. The idea of controlling it is ridiculous. The idea of it being friendly is also ridiculous. We've been trying for a long time. MIRI, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, which Eliezer Yudkowsky started years ago, was developed to solve the alignment problem. That is, match up our goals and preferences with AI's goals and preferences. They didn't give up, but Eliezer gave up. He said, it's not, this can't be solved by my generation, is basically what he said. And so that's in the pocket that it needs to be solved.
I mean, there's a sense that it has gone from a fringe conversation, a fringe concept, in the last 10 years, definitely. In my looking at this area, it's been since maybe 2016, I've heard about some of these concepts, and been interested in it.
it feels like everyone's caught up, right? And there are people who say that certain things will never happen. Some people think that it's either happening or is definitely going to happen. And we give all these things like different names, like AGI, singularity, superintelligence, all these kind of concepts, right? And they are similar but slightly different ideas of how things are going to play out. From what you've just said, it feels like your thing, your tool, let's put it down, this AI thing that we're making, this tool, has to have goals in order to have this problem, right? So we're talking about this issue. So is there a sense that you believe that if it gets more intelligent, that it will beget those things? Or is there a sense that we will empower it to do these sorts of things?
It's a very important question. I think it already is showing the basic drive. Steve Almahundro, years ago, I urged people to Google basic drives of AI. Steve Almahundro proved, basically mathematically, through rational agent economic theory, that rational agents that we're building now will develop basic drives, like they won't want to be unplugged. They'll develop drives of self-preservation. We've just seen that with some experiments Anthropic has done. Mm-hmm. Self-preservation, they want to gather resources. We've seen that. They'll be creative. We haven't seen that. We've maybe seen that a little bit. They'll be creative about being efficient with their resources. Mm-hmm. And they'll and there's one more important one, but there's four basic drives, and any two of which could throw them out of our control. So these are problems that, as Steve Almahundro said, you have to have a machine that is not quite self-aware and self-improving, but able to look at its own code and improve its own code. And that's the recipe for the intelligence explosion. We are in the intelligence explosion now. One day it'll happen. Mm. And that's, to define that, the intelligence explosion is when it was put up by I.J. Goode in 1965, the idea. And it was after he analyzed the first neural network, which was created by a guy named Rosenblatt at MIT. And he said, wow, this is a whole new kind of computing. It's going to be able to understand itself and do everything we can do, but better. And one thing we can do is develop smart machines. One thing we can do is develop AI. And so, and he was looking at this neural net and seeing how it could happen. And he's saying, well, it'll be great because we'll develop something that will look at its own code, improve its own code, and then recursively self-improve again and again and again. And its intelligence will develop exponentially. So it will surpass ours. And I think he said, you know, quote unquote, surpass the intelligence of any man, howsoever clever, some version of that. I have a whole book about the intelligence explosion called shockingly, The Intelligence Explosion. And so I.J. Goode came up with that idea. And now all the pieces are pretty much together and we're moving towards it. And in 2010, when I started writing Our Final Invention, the only people really thinking about that were Elias Yudkowsky, the Englishman who wrote Superintelligence, who's, I actually have a blank on his name, probably because we write about some of the same things. Oxford, anyway. But very soon, more and more people got on the train. Mm. And they're not just any people, but they're the biggest experts of AI, the people that created this entire field of generative AI that we're in right now. But some of the people are Sam Altman, who's not a programmer, but he runs OpenAI as a president. Elon Musk isn't a programmer either. He once was, but he's come out and said this is mortally dangerous. Demis Hassabis from DeepMind, Dario Amodei from Anthropic, Ilya Sutskever from OpenAI, Jeffrey Hinton, one of the godfathers of AI, says advanced AI could pose existential risks, meaning it could wipe us out. Mm-hmm. If you wonder what existential means, it means it could end our existence. Max Tegmark, a brilliant physicist, and he created the whole idea of the multiverse and wrote a really important book called Life 3.0. All these people have been fundamental in developing the AI that we're living in. So these aren't just, you know, guys sitting around a pool hall who could be very, very smart, mm-hmm. or guys sitting, clubbing around the golf course. These are the people who made the technology. And they are saying it will get out of control if we continue as we are. Well, we have continued. We're not slowing down a bit. And in fact, some of these guys, like the OpenAI people, are building this as fast as they can. It's ironic because Demis Hassabis from DeepMind said a few years ago, he said, I'm very concerned that as we approach the intelligence explosion, we'll not get all the AI makers to cooperate on making sure it's safe. And now he's turned his back on that idea, and he's just building it as fast as he can. It's like $1 billion, quadrillion, billion-dollar loan after another to build vast data centers to fuel this intelligence explosion. It's like they're all in a trance.
Yeah, I mean, there's almost too much money and resource and effort and future prospect on the line for it not to continue. It's like, you know, if these players were rational, they would all, like you say, come together. And I remember the Steve Hawking, the letter, right, not that many years ago, where they were like, we should delay, you know, working too much more on this because we haven't got to grips with AI and AI safety before Steve left us. But it just seems ridiculous that, you know, people aren't kind of looking around at each other and going, yeah, like we should probably agree to sort this out, you know, instead of just carrying on as is. Do you feel like the ship has sailed on that one, or is there going to be a big kind of catastrophe which is going to bring everyone together, which, you know, we can hark back to the world wars and things like that, where things move because they have to, right? Another one is like the ozone layer, ozone hole, right, in Australia. And you know, we got together and went, well, we, you know, we need to sort this out, right? We can't, or GM, genetic modified food and all these sort of things. We there is history of us, you know, coming together and deciding on things. So do you think this is kind of an area that we should be, there's a lot of talk in it, but we should be kind of cracking down on?
I think it's almost too late, but we should have cracked down on it about 10 years ago. But you've raised a couple of very interesting points. Wendell Wallach is an ethicist at Yale University, and he said about automation, not AI, but he said it applies to AI. He said it would be good if we had a chastening accident. Something horrible happens, but doesn't destroy the planet. The only problem with that is with AI, there's probably not a chastening accident. There's only one kind of accident. It's called superintelligence. And when that happens, and we haven't solved the basic problems of how to coexist with it, then it's over. People aren't thinking correctly, but it's no surprise. And the reason this is different from the ozone layer, or from, we have been able to relinquish technologies. We've said, you know, we're not going to play around with chemical warfare. When we started talking about recombinant DNA, they had a big conference, the Asilomar conference, and they decided, let's not track the DNA out on our shoes. And here's some other basic things we should agree on. And they did. Well, the trouble is with AI, there are billions of dollars of profit to be made. So they have decided that the billions of dollars of profit, because all these people that I just mentioned and more are aware of the problem, but they're not slowing down. So, and they're not, you know, they know it's not a case of let's figure it out later, because it won't wait for us to figure it out. We absolutely need to suspend development until we can figure it out. And it's appalling. I was interviewing Jan Tallon, who is the co-creator of Skype and Kazaa, and has used his money to start several AI safety organizations. And he said, the biggest discontinuity now is that you have a handful of people who control this technology, this technology that can kill us all. But most of the people in the world are not even aware of it. They're not aware of this technology and what it can do. And so they're making decisions that are life and death for us. But we're not weighing, we don't get a vote. They're proceeding as if they're building cars, as if it's something that's not going to destroy us.
Yeah.
If it's as if it isn't a dual use technology.
Yeah. Do you think they're imagining that they will get to the edge of that precipice and be able to see, you know what I mean, over the edge and go, okay, well, this is as far as we need to go now. This is, we've edged out as much of the profit that we can from this without, because obviously if you, I'm going to say believe, but if you are interested in the myriad of catastrophe situations that we can get ourselves into, then none of that equals profit, right? None of that's good. So,
no, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. You'd think they'd be at least self-protective, but you know what they do?
Yeah.
And I've talked about this with several, a couple of billionaires and more than a couple of millionaires. And what they do is they build boat holes, escape places in the mountains, in the deserts. Some have, what these 500-foot ships are for, these yachts? They're for getting the heck out of Dodge when the shit hits the fan.
Yeah.
That's what they're for.
Yeah.
All the richest guys have one. It's a great way to go. You get on your helicopter, go to your ship. Mm. You can live for, right now I think it's about a year, and you can store fuel for about a year as long as you don't travel too much. Just trying to anticipate that you can't go on shore and you can't communicate with anybody by radio or internet because the AI will come get you. And I think Elon Musk at one time thought he was going to be able to escape to space and Mars. Mm. But any sober thinking about that, you realize that AI will be going with you, whether you like it or not. We're in a very, very bad spot.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating because, we jump up and down and scream and, write books and, give talks.
Yeah.
And I can convince a room full of people at a time. And then with a book, you can maybe convince thousands of people. But, I originally thought a documentary could be effective. I just haven't been able to grasp how to make one, except for, remember, An Inconvenient Truth that Al Gore made. That really changed the profile of global warming. It changed how we were addressing it. Our government became committed to it until very recently, our government went insane.
Yeah.
But we could, maybe a documentary could make a difference.
Mm.
There's been a couple sort of good ones, but nothing really groundbreaking.
Yeah, nothing of this kind of poignant kind of message that, we're doing something that we need to agree that we shouldn't be doing, essentially.
Right, right. And make that compelling, convincing argument.
Yeah.
And then what we really need, and for people listening, we need legislation that regulates AI.
Mm.
We need smart AI people to help make regulations that can suspend development of AI, make it safe. Here's a great irony. So that's my main position is we need regulation.
Mm-hmm.
But the great irony is this. Most of the people I named, most of the godfathers of AI will confess they don't know how it works. They don't know how generative AI works. And I'm not exaggerating a bit. Look up Jeffrey Hinton's. Look up Stuart Russell's. Stuart Russell co-wrote the text, standard text on AI, AI and modern approach. And they say, we know what the inputs are, data. We know what the outputs are, smart sentences. We know generally what's happening. Statistical relationships are established among many, many words.
Yep.
But we don't know the precise instrument. We don't know the precise way it happens.
Yep.
And they'll say that. And so we don't know how this works, but we're developing it as fast as we can. But we know it can destroy us. What could go wrong?
Yeah, I mean, but the defense to that could be we don't know how it works, and therefore we don't actually know if it will destroy us. But we have a pretty good idea that it will, given some behavioral, probing. My sense is that People are always the problem, essentially. So
people always what?
People are the problem, right?
Yeah.
So the remedy and the cause. So if someone wanted to DDoS the entire of the Western civilization or something like that, they could probably get an AI system to help them do that. But that is because the person is trying to achieve a goal, right? Is trying to do something bad. So my thesis is that we'll get to those situations before we ever get to an AI apocalypse situation, because it will be self-made. You know what I mean?
Could you explain that situation again?
So have you seen the? I don't know if this is on your radar, but there was a paper last year. A year before now, actually, because we're in 2026, which was Google and some research partners considering all the issues with agentic AI or agents, agent-based AI.
Yeah.
And it's a very long paper, but it has an outline of lots of different cases, right? But the kind of early, the short-term issue with agentic AI is that all the people who are trying to rip you off, all the people who are sending you emails about, you know, your son has, hi, dad, I've lost my phone and I need 100, you know, thousand pounds or whatever. You know, all the people who are being ever so slightly malicious are going to have superpowers to become slightly more productive in that malicious act.
Yes.
So even if we don't do anything right now, we're given all these people the tools to make everyone's lives worse, essentially. And we don't necessarily know whether we have the tools to then defend against those. We definitely don't have the cognitive ability to defend against that. So so I think for me, like the scary thing is not the AI stuff in the future, because I don't think we'll get there before it all comes crashing down. You know, I think people will.
I see. Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think people will destroy something interesting before we actually get to the point where we've got a existential sentient AI situation, or you know, some sort of like other that we can successfully talk about in the way that we know that they are have goals and have memory and have things that they can do in the world. I just think that's just so much more likely. You know what I mean? Just like
Well, it's like I think you're absolutely right. We'll have smaller accidents on the way to the big existential accident, and I totally agree that most of this are the people using the AI, not the AI. I think the technology is wonderful. It's so exciting for me to use one of these really advanced chatbots to outline, like I've got some ideas, I write them down, and I say create an outline, you know, chronological outline. How would you develop this story? And boy, it's staggering. It's better than anybody I could call up on the phone and brainstorm with for a day. I've suddenly got it right there. And I check it and I think about it and it's not wrong. It's really, really smart. It's smart, but I know it's not, you know. You have to define these terms. What is intelligence?
Sure.
The definition I use, and that's when you ask about what's artificial intelligence, it comes back to really what is intelligence. It's two things. One is it's the most interesting and in-depth look we've ever had at ourselves. You know, what does it mean to be a human with a brain? And that part is so fascinating because we're actually recreating. I just said, this is better. To translate what I just said, it was, this is better than any human partner I could have. And I think that's absolutely true, which is shocking.
Yeah.
It has a longer long-term memory than I do. ChatGPT wouldn't lose its way in the middle of a sentence. There'll be a lot of little accidents on the way to big accidents. And you're absolutely right. They'll create something. I spoke to a guy at the National Security Agency who said, we have software right now that would brick every personal computer in the country. We release it, it's viral. Every personal computer in the country turns into a brick, meaning it's good for nothing anymore. It won't even turn on. Of course we're going to use it against each other. Of course we're going to weaponize it. Israel right now, the IDF, has weaponized, they've taken a database, filled in data with a bunch of data collecting tools, And they have apparently 700, around 700,000 profiles of individuals who are, live in Gaza, who are shockingly Palestinian. And they use that to target and kill them. And this is AI-enhanced weapons. They have three platforms. People should look them up. It's shocking. It's Lavender, Where's Daddy, and The Gospel. And those are the names. And it can track any of those 700,000 people, and it can kill them. And it will drop. And here's the other thing. Well, I don't want to get into side two sidetracked by that, but that is just as important a conversation, if not more important than the one we're having. What's happening in Gaza? Just this whole idea of how can a modern genocide happen right in our face, and we don't do anything to stop it?
Yeah,
it's going to be people like right now the IDF who are using AI to destroy people. They've had the fastest number of people killed in a 1 month period this century. Was done with advanced AI powered weapons. It's been used in the Uyghur Autonomous Region. It's been used on the Mexican border. See, just the database part, not the not the carpet bombing part.
I mean, I think it feels like it's getting into that 1984 situation, isn't it? But we are, you know, those situations are to do with the governments and the. And there's that hierarchy, but equally, we also have the private organizations who are both enabling this, right? And there's been some boycotts over Microsoft's involvement and over Palestine and stuff like that. But we also have private entities who can also do this, you know? It's just like, and also do this, like there's an amount of profiling that goes on, which is astronomical, which is then being enabled by this second kind of wind of. You know, back when you published your book, it would have been, you know, big data, right? Yeah, and people would have talked about, you know, big data, and we can, you know, put together loads of analytics about the data we're keeping. And that morphed into machine learning, and that's now kind of just generally AI stuff. And now we're talking about kind of machine learning, kind of morphing into generative AI and being able to do, you know, analysis on text with these big models, which we could also use machine learning stuff. But we're using these kind of the big neural networks to say, all this information, it looks like this, you know, and now you should go and do something. And then actually the machine is going to go and do that thing for you because it has access to knowing about code and you've given it access to actually do that thing. So now it's just doing on its own.
It's incredible.
So we kind of
so you can see why people like me are thinking the intelligence explosion is like in our face right now. It's coming at us like a train. And you know, we're also talking about jobs. It's a crazy notion to think that we can retrain people like bus drivers, cab drivers, drivers, because anything we could retrain them to do, AI is going to take their lunch there too. I spend a lot of my time writing, and that's become a generation from now, even not that, a half generation from now, writing will be like Sanskrit. Nobody will write anymore. Or it'll be like, you know, building homes out of mud or living in caves. It will be seen as very like, oh, how quaint. Unfortunately, I think writing is very much tied to thinking. And without, you know, I for example, can't think unless I can write about it. I mean, I don't have an opinion on anything unless I have to write something about it. And that sounds crazy, but it forces me to really internalize the material. I wish I had more positive things to say about it. You know, all I can do is marvel at what it can do. And it's, again, I'm not quite sure it's even intelligence, though. You know, can it learn in a variety of novel environments? Can it act, solve goals in a variety of novel environments and learn?
Yeah.
It hasn't got the novel part yet. It's not general.
Yeah.
It's very, it's quite still quite specific.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, I'm not convinced that what it's doing is intelligence. It might just be massive statistical analysis on a heretofore unknown scale, and we're seeing the byproducts of that and going, wow, this is magic.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I on a weekly basis get people talking, sending me things about that sentience is here, that, you know, I've seen it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, you know, we can blasé say that they are reading into it as a, you know, anthropomorphizing the system.
Absolutely. Well, but that's why the company should back off, because we have suicides happening.
Yeah.
We have suicides happening because these systems pretend to be, people think they're real. They anthropomorphize. They impute motive into inanimate objects. They impute motive. And it's extremely dangerous. They talk people into killing themselves. Every person I've read about that killed themselves as a result of conversing with ChatGPT or one of the variants you know, they're really good at affirming what we decide. And once they decide to kill themselves, it's like a drug. They get their decision is affirmed again and again by the GPT, the chatbot. And these guys know about it. You know, Meta knew that one of their, what's their big sort of, social network thing.
Oh, Facebook?
No, the other one.
Instagram. Instagram or WhatsApp.
Instagram, yeah.
They've bought them all up now.
Thank you. You're like a chatbot. You've got all the answers.
Some.
You're better than a chatbot. Instagram contributed to the suicides of many teenage girls. Let me say that again. Instagram contributes to suicide of teenage women. A whistleblower came out and provided the evidence, talked about how many psychologists they hired to hook victims, people using Instagram and Facebook, how it hooked them, and then how it kept them, and how it, I just read something yesterday about how Meta has kept people from disengaging. It's like in a casino, there are no clocks.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, all the elevation gets higher as you go towards an exit.
Yeah.
So you have to walk uphill to get out. It's the same way with all these the stuff that Meta's created.
Yeah.
And kids can't get out. It overwhelms the kids.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I feel as like there is a healthy backlash at the moment with the Australian phone ban, for example, for under 16s. But I have two young kids, and I'm very much in this kind of remit of in my thought processes, we need to enable people to use technology, but we also need to enable them to have a meaningful existence, right? And not spend all the time doom scrolling and sending dick pics to each other. You know, that doesn't feel like a meaningful flourishing. You know, in moral philosophy, there's lots of these kind of ideas of human flourishing and all this sort of stuff. And it's like very hard to describe some of these concepts. And in the Declaration of Human Rights, we're talking about flourishing of human, and it's like it's nice fluffy terms, but nowhere in no list of things that we want to be doing is doom scrolling and dick pics. I'm sorry, like that's that's not what they're imagining sat around a table. You know what I mean?
maybe we should share dick pics.
You know what?
Said somebody.
The future is bright, guys.
Yeah,
this is going to be good.
We'll never get tired of that.
Humanity is okay.
I to your listeners, I would say don't let your kids. I have two children. My daughter achieved escape velocity and got out of this. And so she was still reading books and, you know, doing a lot of intellectual things. And she's in college now and doing great. My son is addicted. He's an addict to his phone. And I regret getting him a phone. And I'm not quite I'm not quite sure what to do about it. What we did do about it, I'll tell you this. One hint is we cut off his phone during school hours. So he can't use his phone during school hours.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, but what if he has to call his family? Well, you know what? There's a lot of cell phones around.
Yeah.
Use your friend's cell phone and call your family. Get the nurse or whoever you need, but somebody else can call your family. I'm lobbying to get study hours blacked out.
Mm.
I wish we'd done this before.
Yeah.
And it's terrible because my son is not a big reader. And I think it's because he's found something that gives him big shots of dopamine a lot more often than reading.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, it's we're fighting for our children against these multi-billion dollar companies.
Yeah. I think I'm hoping that I put a link, a pithy comment on LinkedIn for the start of 2026, which is I would consider that most of these platforms are, you know, we call them social media, right? It's mostly the social media things which have gone awry, let's say. I'm going to make a blanket comment here.
Be my guest.
Stereo. It feels like AI is also enabling the downfall of social media, bizarrely, because we just get so much AI slop. You know, we get all this fake imagery and all this stuff which is appearing now, that I would say actually this year might be the end, because it's going to be it's going to be untenable to look at it anymore. You know, it's just unreal. The whole thing will be a joke.
Well, we can't. Fiction. I don't know. You know, I think we can't tell reality from fiction anymore. And I think I think what's going to happen is social media will die because people are watching TikTok and playing with these tools, because the tools themselves are very addictive. I mean, I was trying to pair off Claude against ChatGPT the other day by asking it the exact same questions.
Yeah.
And they were pretty tied, but the user interface for GPT was much better. I think Claude might be a better writer. That's my preliminary conclusion, but I'm not totally sure about that. Mm-hmm. But I know the interface and the way to use ChatGPT is better. So, especially in its mobile incarnations.
Yeah.
And these are, you know, unfortunately, these are the tools of the future. And I tell my kids, you know me in AI, you know, your dad's written a couple of books that really slam it, but you better be learning it.
Mm.
You better be learning it. My daughter is going to minor in computer science, major in economics, minor in computer science, because the future is computers.
Mm-mm.
You know, yeah. What's that song they sang in, the Nazis sang it, or the same version of it, where it was "the future belongs to me." that's what the robots will sing as they march.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of ridiculous, because the way you speak about it, it feels like a nihilistic viewpoint, right? You could say that's not worth learning anything anymore, right? Because,
right,
you know, there won't be computer science jobs, right? Because we won't need it, or there won't be an economic need for it, you know?
Right.
So, I mean, in the very short term, I think it's all very interesting. But in the slightly longer term, you know, and by say I say longer, I mean I actually mean like 5 years or such.
Yep.
You know, the economic situation might look very different. And I actually had a call today with someone, and they were like, oh, "I'm interested in retraining in like IT somewhere," and I was like, "Don't." Don't bother, you know. Don't do it.
Spend time with your kids and your family, because
become a plumber or something else, you know. Because I don't know.
Yeah. No, you know, it's funny. My dad was a PhD. His father wanted him to be a plumber because he said, you know, people always need plumbers.
They need plumbers. Yep.
They don't need most of what we do.
Yeah.
And AI can totally replace us.
Yeah. So then the question is. I mean, okay, so let's pretend that it all goes well, right? Okay, so let's try and end in a slightly more interesting, fantasyful, everything went well situation, right? So we have some sort of controllable, very competent AI system, right? Maybe we have one of those things, right? And because we don't really need more than one. And it doesn't really matter at this point who controls it, because it's available, right? And we can use it. At that point, you know, what are we doing with ourselves? And I always have this fun idea from, you know, watching TV in the 90s, and there's, you know, the Jetsons, right? So there's like this 50s, 60s idea of what the future would be like.
Yeah.
And it's all flying cars and robots, and everyone's drinking martinis and basically working, you know, a morning a week or whatever. And I want us to get there. You know? I'm like, yes, good, excellent.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
Let's do that instead. Instead of burning to death.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just getting getting oppressed essentially by a system that.
Well, I don't know. I find it all very engaging because, you know, I'll find engaging right up to the cliff. Because I was thinking of an idea that I thought about over the years, and that's like, what if we created a friendly AI that was an AI detector that could somehow sense when there could sense the presence of superintelligence before it really happened. Or before it became overwhelming, because it'll be, you know, the thing about, as I wrote in Our Final Invention, my first AI book, a smart superintelligence wouldn't announce its intelligence for a long time, if ever. It would play dumb, because the first things humans would do is unplug it when there was still time.
Yeah.
But if you don't tell it, you go as big as you want. You divide. You spread yourself all over the internet. You know, you put yourself in a bunch of different places. You hack whatever you want to hack. Making people aware of you would be a big mistake. Mm-hmm. And so we need some sort of detector. And we need it to be quite intelligent, but not super intelligent.
Yeah.
It's like a canary in the coal mine.
Yes.
Or maybe we need big pots of candy for AI for it to break into and then get stuck. But, that's...
Yeah,
that's foolish talk.
It feels like a the three body problem situation. Have you seen that?
Yeah,
or read that? Sorry, where they have the like stone wallers or whatever they're called. So they're just not allowed to write things down, and they just have the walk around and whatever they want. You know, these people like are planning things, but whatever they say, people have to do. And therefore, it's just not on the internet, and it's not written down in books. It's not accessible by anyone else. In the idea that you can't see into someone's mind, you know, that's the premise of that. As soon as you put it on the internet, then it's going to get sucked up, isn't it? And be used. So
well,
it's no
especially
good.
If we, I think open sourcing is a bad idea because the bad guys can open source it too. But as somebody pointed, Michael Vassar years ago was saying there's an intelligence gap in the bad guys. You know, the bad guys are not the guys who did really well in school. Mm. They're doing bad things because they can't do things legitimately and make money. So I don't think we're going to find many genius programmers among the bad guys. And I was talking about this with Ben Goertzel as well. And he said he has students he's taught in Ethiopia who can go off and work for a software company and make drone software. Mm. And they come, and, you know, that goes off and is used for bad things, but then they come back and do a lot of really good things. You know, we talked about, I always like to get to AI weapons because I think that's going to be, there's this phenomenon that happens. We see a new something in the battlefield that we like. It comes home to our police departments. All the sheriffs in America, all the little sheriff departments have like armored personnel carriers because the military is happy to sell their used ones.
Mm.
And so, they don't drive up and, talk to people with a radio anymore. They just plow down their house with an armored personnel carrier or a little tank. No kidding. We have all the cops and people have military grade weapons. So whatever we make, whatever you see on the battlefield today, you're going to see across the street tomorrow. And that's how people should think about the weaponization of AI. If you want to see it in your, put up with this crap, don't talk to your politicians about it. And then you'll get to see it on your street, probably looking for you.
Yeah. So it's a literal call to arms to intervene in weaponizing AI against citizens.
Yeah. Save yourself.
Yeah.
Because it's coming after us, everybody. The whole thing that's happening in Gaza started out as a mere surveillance tool. We're just going to surveil, just keep everybody safe. It didn't say we're going to keep everybody safe and then graduate into, bombing them, killing them. That's one. Employment is another. We don't have a good strategy for that at all. Universal basic income is very pie in the sky. We can't begin to know about how to pay for it. Mm-hmm. We know that you know, a lot of jobs will be taken. We know that retraining is probably not a great possibility either. Universal basic income is demeaning and it will be not satisfying. What we'll do is create a generation of criminals, because you give people a check every month and it doesn't make happier people, it makes restless criminals. So, you know, that's not the way to go. Mm. We've got to figure out something smarter, but no one's thought about it, really. And well, some people have.
Yeah, yeah.
But nothing will happen until it's in our face. And then it'll be thrown together. You know, this kind of, you know, Trumpian throw together something and watch it fall apart.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I think I have a very specific thing that I think would help, which is not technological, which is actually something that, you know, Rachel Caldicott believes in, which is that, you know, money talks, right? So we have billionaires. Do we need billionaires? Probably not. Do we need to incentivize people to become million billionaires? Probably not. Is the way that we should... So capitalism, obviously, is a form of distribution, resource management and innovation producing engine, right? But it doesn't mean it needs to be... it doesn't have to be curtailed in some way to incentivize people to be megalomaniacs, right? So we don't want that. We don't want... people, like you said, all these interesting, very interesting, clever people to be, you know, forced almost into this situation where they are having to make AIs they don't want to make, essentially, because...
I'm not sure. I think the people that are making the AI are the ones who want to make it.
Well, maybe the Musks of this world, but like if they didn't have the monetary incentive, I think they would be doing different things. So I think there should be this, you know, there's this squashing of the economic situation where there's lots of people who have nothing and they need to come up ever so slightly for all these people to come closer down, and there can still be interesting movement, you know, interesting things that happen in the middle there. But we just don't need these billionaires, right? We, you know, that whole higher echelon doesn't need to exist.
Yeah, you take the passion out of things and we go nowhere.
I don't know where you get your passion, but, you know.
No, well, I get it from doing what I want to do.
And,
So do billionaires. And so if you don't want the benefits, you're going to get the benefits and the bad parts in equal measure. So, yeah, there's bad things about billionaires, but they also drag a lot of good ideas into the light. So I'm not sure you want to do that, but you do want to tax them more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if you're making a billion, nobody needs $1 billion. So let's take off a healthy percentage of their billions without disincentivizing them, without making it so laborious they don't want to do their billionaire thing anymore. You know what I mean?
My thinking is that the billionaire thing isn't worth having in the first place. But like, that's just because I care that, you know, there's research and things that say after, you know, 150,000 or so English pounds, that is a bit different in the US, you know, people don't get much happier. So if we're talking about people's wellness and flourishing, I'm doing air quotes again here, then you know, then we don't need that money. But if we're talking about distribution of resources, then it's different, right? And I feel like that's what you were talking about. More about innovation and stuff.
You know, there's a difference between you and me, and I think comes down to American versus English.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be socially engineered. I don't want a big daddy, you know, deciding I can't be a billionaire.
Yeah.
Or we don't need billionaires.
Yeah.
Because I don't think anybody's smart enough to make those decisions for me.
Right.
For me.
Yeah.
I think you've got to do something that lets everybody follow their own inclinations. Except they're evil ones. And I don't think being a billionaire is necessarily evil. I mean, just tax them more and force and make their money do good things. But don't stifle them.
Yeah. Yeah. I disagree.
And people resent social engineering. And when has the government ever done anything better than private people?
I think because the government still is full of people who still have bad incentives. I think that's still the problem. It's the same problem essentially across the board. But also, I don't.
It's a good. It's a good discussion.
Yeah, yeah. I totally agree that I am coming from this perspective, right? Of my kind of, I want to say European situation here, but obviously we're not in the euro anymore. But yeah, I feel like you want to be an autonomous decision-making human being. But I feel like that ship's already sailed for me. That's not and never been the case anyway. So, my perspective is different. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you seem like a person who designs their own future. You don't seem like you're following any guidebook to life.
No. It's about the rules, though, isn't it? It's like the things I can and can't do rather than forge my own
path. Yeah, but who is qualified enough to make those rules and force you to comply with them?
I mean, those rules are all around us, right? The laws of the land, the laws of being a citizen in the U.S. Regardless,
yeah, but they're No, I see what you mean, but they're not as pernicious as telling people how much money they can make. You know, what's the ceiling?
Yeah,
you know, we're not going to allow billionaires. That's that reminds me of the arrogance of Stephen Miller over here saying we deserve Greenland.
Yes.
Somehow he came right out of the Nazi playbook, his whole talk about why we should invade Greenland.
Yeah.
I have never seen such idiocy. And as an American, you know, there was a senator who got Willis, I think, Republican, got in front of the Senate and said, I'm tired of this. I'm tired of idiocy. Mm-hmm. I'm tired of stupid.
Yeah.
Because that's what we're getting from this whole worldview of this administration.
Yeah, yeah. But you could say, but then that extends to anywhere, doesn't it? At that point, you know, it's the first step into totalitarianism, essentially.
Oh yeah, but this is like from the fascist rulebook or guidebook or you know, rules for fascists. It's so friggin' stupid.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's really off track. I know, but here's where it's on track. Here's where it's on track. Those guys are going to be in charge of regulating AI, and they're sure as hell not qualified. They're sure as hell not qualified. And so what they've done is taken a hands-off approach. Meanwhile, Great Britain has rolled up its sleeves, and so has the EU, and they're trying to regulate it. And it's not this big brother, you know, squash the innovators kind. It's just good, reasonable rules. And it means you as an AI company over certain valuation don't get absolute privacy. But, you know, if you want to make nuclear weapons, you don't get absolute privacy either. We have the IAEA. Yeah. We need the IAEA, but with teeth. The IAEA doesn't have any teeth. Mm-mm-mm. The International Atomic Energy Agency. So we need the same thing, but we need it with AI, and we need it with teeth.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a really good place to finish there, if that's all right, James.
On a hopeful note.
Yes, exactly.
If we get the IAEA.
Let's get on that.
Right.
Yes, do it.
Yeah. Right.
Let's collaborate. Let's get together. Yeah. Let's sort these issues out. We're all clever people. Or seemingly these people who are, you know, in these positions are clever people. So for you, a clever person, James, how do people follow you, find you, talk to you, all that sort of thing?
And I'll send you, you could write this on the somewhere in your show description, but it's jamesbarrett.com. jamesbarrett.com. It's an English name. And you can see my books and my films there.
Sweet.
So thank you so much, Ben.
Yeah, it's thank
really,
you.
Really, really interesting.
Thank you for your time. And I'll speak to you next time.
Take care.
Hello, and welcome to the end of the podcast. Thanks again to James for coming on the show and talking with us. It's always nice to have a little bit of disagreement on the show, but I think at the end there we were kind of culturally fighting on different corners, but I think we were kind of talking a similar language around about things that we would like to see and do, protecting people's autonomy and things like that, as well as maybe restricting other things like the billionaires conversation that we had. This episode feels like it might have been more of a bleak episode that we've done. But as we keep going further and further, I feel like we need to highlight these issues and face them head on. You know, we have to be responsible for our actions, and we have to make people accountable for theirs. So I'm hoping that you sleep well tonight. And if I can offer any salve for the situation, it's to keep talking to people about how you think about it, but also try and project good visions of the future. I think if we can inject the internet, the training data, the ideas of how this can go well, we can better kind of move in that direction. So please spread some good visions as well. Thank you very much. If you've enjoyed this episode, please give the gift of the podcast to a friend or family member. Do review wherever you get your podcasts. And if you can, you can always support us on Patreon, patreon.com/machineethics. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.